Welcome to Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran, where we explore the frontiers of health and wellness with the brightest minds in medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm an interventional cardiologist. And in the medical landscape, there's a division between traditional approaches and alternative approaches. And there are physicians who dare to bridge these worlds, bringing together the best of evidence-based medicine with innovative strategies that address the whole person. I am thrilled today to welcome Dr. Bobby Kumar, a family physician whose 15-year journey has taken her beyond conventional medicine into the realms of preventive care, obesity medicine, and longevity science. Based in Texas, Dr. Kumar has developed a reputation for blending functional and traditional approaches to help patients achieve their health goals in a way that conventional medicine alone often misses. What happens when we stop treating symptoms and start addressing root causes? How might we reimagine our approach to conditions like obesity? And what controversial practices in longevity medicine might actually transform how we age? Well, Dr. Kumar doesn't shy away from these difficult questions or challenging medical orthodoxy when patient outcome is at stake. And today we will explore the intersection of lifestyle medicine, weight management, and the science of aging, including some approaches that are that has divided the medical community. So Dr. Kumar, thank you so much for joining us on Reboot. Let's dive into a conversation that might just change how our listeners think about their health journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Arsi. So it's definitely an honor to be a part of your podcast. I've listened to a few of your episodes, and I love how you are approaching this from a very holistic standpoint. And I think this is the right audience and the right venue to be able to dispel some of the rumors and myths that stand around GLPs.
Fantastic. So, you know, let's start with, you know, your journey. You spent 15 years, you started with family practice, and then you went into functional medicine. So tell me a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, great question. I have done bread and butter primary care for many, many years. I had full intention of being one of those primary care doctors who would see their patients in the hospital when they got sick, who followed them to skilled nursing facilities. And I had done that for quite some time. And then over the course of my career, started to really delve into how do I impact patients in a larger way, in a more targeted way, where I'm looking at what is the problem that we're trying to solve, where patients are not getting the care that they're looking for. And so my journey has kind of, I would say, deviated outside of just the clinic walls. So now my primary job is with looking at how healthcare has different gaps in reaching patients the way they need to be reached. And I work with a multitude of companies that help to solve for this exact problem. How are we transforming the care that we're bringing to patients? How are we making this experience better with physicians? And so now, currently in my primary role, I'm helping to find ways to capture interest and harness the energy around living healthier for longer than what is currently existing in traditional healthcare.
Fantastic. I mean, it's a commendable journey. I thank you so much. You know, we need more primary care physicians kind of taking this approach and making it sustainable. And I think maybe with this shift and change in attitude, we might actually practice health instead of disease, you know.
This is interesting because when we talk about healthcare, we say that we're really being preventative, right? That we want to take a very preventative approach. We're screening for cancers, we're screening for certain conditions, like doing a blood pressure check is something as simple as saying we're screening for hypertension. But truth be told, where we can find the greatest gains in our approach as physicians and clinicians is being able to instill the right principles that drive patients towards healthier lifestyles, towards healthier behaviors and habits, much earlier on than the point in time that they come in for their blood pressure check. But the way that healthcare exists today, we are in a reactive state. We're constantly chasing ourselves. And the approach that we have taken now, I feel like you're seeing more and more traction of physicians and patients together working collaboratively towards an achievable plan. And so my hope is that we continue down this path where we can provide the information and education to patients where more often than not, they're getting this information very easily now with social media and technology. It's right at their fingertips. But now I think the physician role, the clinician role is to how do we make this information digestible, easy to understand, and something that is easy to implement into our day-to-day.
You know, that's literally the reason why I started this podcast, because I felt like, I mean, an interventional cardiologist, I put stents in patients, and now these 60-year-old and 70-year-old are like, what do I do? How can I make sure I don't get another heart attack? And then I start preaching about, you know, you have to exercise and you have to do this. And I'm like, it's impossible to change your habits at 60s and 70s and sometimes even 80-year-olds. You know, we need to catch them early, or we need to send this message across much earlier. And that's where, like, we need to improve the health awareness of people, because we are taught about some amount of finances, some amount of bookkeeping, some amount of accounting, and how to go through life. But no one talks about how to stay healthy in school or in college. You know, it never happens.
Well, they also, and I think this is just society as a whole, we often have the perspective that society creates. So for example, the fact that obesity continues to be something that is not widely spoken about, that for some reason is only closely tied to lifestyle habits, not that it's a chronic, complex, neurohormonal driven medical condition, it is a lifestyle choice. Mm-hmm. And this is why there's so much discussion in media about what is the appropriate approach towards obesity, what is the appropriate approach towards weight management. And it is seen as a failure on an individual's part if they're having to tap into medication or tap into additional help to support their journey. Whereas we don't carry that exact same belief when we are approaching hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or even mental health. We don't carry that same stigma.
All right. You know, obesity is often seen as a gateway to chronic diseases, but we have also seen people live long, healthy lives with a higher body weight. So do you think the relationship between obesity and longevity is kind of oversimplified?
I believe it is more than just oversimplified. It's actually underestimated. And I think a lot of it has to do with when we're comparing apples to apples. So just having a BMI, I don't think is a good indicator of health. If you look at it, because what it's not telling me is the amount of fat that we have, around our visceral organs, or what we describe as visceral adiposity, which is the driver towards cardiovascular disease. So when you look at a BMI, you can have someone who has a BMI of 25 and they have very different body shapes and they have very different deposition of adipose tissue. So we don't have a very good defined screening tool in the current healthcare as it stands that tells us what an individual's risk is just based off of their weight. And so when you talk about obesity, we still use obesity diagnostic criteria based off of BMI, but BMI alone does not tell us where fat deposits lie. And because we don't have that information readily accessible when we're seeing the patient in front of us, it is a very difficult conversation to have with an individual to discuss what their risks are. And so that's why I say it is not just oversimplified, it's very underestimated, because I can have an individual walk in with a BMI of 24.5 and they could be at much greater risk for long-term chronic conditions or metabolic dysfunction than someone who does not have visceral adipose tissue deposition.
Yeah, those are the thin on the outside but fat on the inside people, right?
Yes.
The toffee paradigm.
We call them skinny fat.
Skinny fat, yes. And that's the most scariest kind of thing, where their body size and their body appearance gives them a lot of confidence that they are healthy, but they are so inflamed. And almost every time when I see a very thin patient on my cath lab table, I know their blood vessels are going to be horrendously calcified, and I'll have to bring out all the other guns to clean out the calcium in their blood vessels.
Yes. And I think this is why looking at obesity just as a lifestyle choice is a lot of the driver behind this, because just being of a normal BMI, or what we describe as being a normal BMI, doesn't preclude you from being on your cath table.
That is a very clear
indicator for us as physicians to look at the whole person. What does their family history look like? What does their lipoprotein profile look like?
Exactly.
What is their body composition? You know, we have to take a very targeted approach when we're looking at metabolic dysfunction. How do the hormones play into this? And how can we optimize this individual based on their history, based on their biomarkers, to be put on the path towards healthy aging?
You know, in the recent years, this health at every size movement has gained a lot of traction, right? Mm-hmm. Where do you see value in this perspective, and where might you diverge from this perspective?
That's an excellent question. I am definitely an advocate of ensuring that every individual has the unfettered access to health. The way that it stands right now is that there is unseen and unrecognized bias when an individual who is overweight or obese comes into a physician's office or a clinic of any kind. There is a distinct bias that is seen with these individuals when they show up in the emergency room. And so when we talk about health at every size, it's about acceptance of an individual to be able to walk into a gym and be able to work out and use the equipment without having to face criticism, critiquing, or this underlying bias that a lot of individuals face. So I definitely agree with that. However, I think fixating on just size as an indicator of health is the part where I diverge, because it is not just about what size pants that you wear. Going back to what we talked about, it is how our body is functioning at the most intimate levels with our lipid metabolism and insulin regulation, that we have to be able to determine, are we actually performing optimally right now? And so I am a huge advocate for those individuals who may not be a BMI of 25, but are advocating for exercise and healthy habits, including sleep and nutrition. And I am a huge advocate for those individuals. But I do not think that it is appropriate to just say, we're just going to accept everyone's choices when it comes to either maintaining that. I don't think that we just have to accept that an individual, that is their
destiny or
destiny. I don't believe that we need to just accept that that is their destiny. I think there
Absolutely.
Are specific things that each person can have ownership over, and that includes their choices for nutrition and how they exercise, the types of exercise that they do, their exposure to sunlight, the types of supplements they're taking. I think those are things that if we provide that education, every person should take advantage of.
So as a lifestyle medicine practitioner and a family medicine practitioner, how do you treat a patient who comes to you for obesity or any other chronic diseases for that matter, metabolic diseases?
When they're coming to me, when a patient is coming to me, at this point, they may or may not have already seen a primary care doctor, and which is completely acceptable. But if they're coming to me, they are seeking a solution for a problem. And oftentimes I find my patients telling me that, you know, we'll just speak on obesity. If they are talking about weight management, usually the problem to solve is, I used to be able to lose weight very easily before, and no matter what I'm doing now, I cannot lose these last 15 pounds or the last 40 pounds, or I am not able to lose the weight that I gained with my pregnancy. That is the problem to solve. My approach is to get a very clear understanding of where they currently sit with their lifestyle habits. What we are misunderstanding, or maybe not giving enough credence to, is how sleep affects hormone regulation, how our nutrition does, how exposure to sunlight, how social connections, underlying depression, underlying anxiety, how it is a balance of all of these behaviors that allow us to be able to perform at our best. So oftentimes I'll take this patient, I'll do their biomarkers, I'm checking for potential drivers for metabolic dysregulation. But in turn, I'm giving them a very clear understanding of where they currently sit and how those different buckets within lifestyle, our pillars of lifestyle medicine, contribute towards them not achieving their goal. So when we talk about obesity or we're talking about weight management, a lot of my patients are women. They are in this 30s to, yeah, I would say mid-50s range, where they're talking about the weight changes that they've experienced. But then we start talking about, let's talk about their stress levels. We're starting to explore how their sleep has been impacted. We're starting to explore how their nutrition has fallen off because, gosh, they're eating toddler food because they have very young kids. And the idea of having to prepare multiple meals for multiple people is very, it's onerous for them. So we start by breaking down the area that they are struggling with the most and how they can make incremental changes towards achieving traction in that area. So my approach is such that I give them things that they can control, and then I support them with the choice and education on ways to make this more successful.
Interesting. I mean, you know, when I had to do my own weight loss journey after my kids, each pregnancy, it was just a yin yang, go yo, yo, yo. And finally, I had to sit down and break it down. And I said, I have to investigate why I am gaining weight. And it, for me, it came to sugar addiction and chocolate addiction. And I had to work through that. But there is an ongoing debate, right, whether food addiction is a legitimate diagnosis or a helpful framework. Based on your clinical experience, how do you approach this concept?
What I am finding is that it is less about food addiction in a lot of my patients. It is more about the imbalance of the hormones. So you have leptin, you have ghrelin. These are two hormones that regulate both satiety and hunger. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing are those individuals who have, behaviors towards eating in excess, or they have behaviors towards where they are unable to turn off their brain when it comes to food. The centers of the brain that help to control or at least receive these signals on hunger and satiety are also the same centers of the brain that focus on addiction. So when we talk about food, it's not that necessarily that every individual is addicted to food, but when they have this imbalance or they have excess leptin or they have excess ghrelin hormones, they're unable to turn it off. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my patients, when they are dieting, especially when they're, even for my journey, you talked about your journey. I've had a very similar journey. Mine was even before kids. I have always been overweight my entire life. So knowing how I feel when I'm going through a very strict caloric reduction diet, I am that the hunger hormones, the food noise, the constant thoughts around food, I feel like I'm increasingly hungry. I'm unable to turn those hormones. And so that is when we start to realize that as a chronic disease, it's a hormonal imbalance. Those individuals who are dealing with obesity have their signals turned on. And sometimes when they go through phases of diets and, fast, those hormones even kick up 10, 15 notches. It is much harder to control individually. And when we think about when we have a hormone imbalance, if we don't have enough thyroid hormone, we're taking exogenous medications, right? We're taking medications to put the hormones in our body or to regulate them. We did not have those types of tools readily available to those individuals who are dealing with obesity until just recently.
You know, that kind of segues into your discussion on fasting, because fasting has been used as a tool, as a longevity tool. It has been I have fasted myself and I enjoy the fast by itself, but then I ended up with fasting fatigue and I had to move away from that. But what do you think about fasting? Is this truly a legitimate tool in our armamentarium?
It depends on what is the ultimate goal. If you're looking at it from an aging perspective, there are some studies that talk about how caloric reduction and intermittent fasting has actually helped to improve telomere length. But if you're talking about managing obesity, if you're talking about weight, the truth is there are very few diets that have had success long-term for weight management. Fasting has never been one of those things that has been helpful. There is a study in regards to intermittent fasting as it pertains to glucose regulation. But what we are finding is that the rebound, where you get regain, is much higher if you're not able to sustain these habits long-term. So it is interesting when we talk about longevity versus obesity, but what I'm finding is that the myth was that fasting as a whole would be an excellent tool to help with weight management. And I'm finding more and more it is entirely not true.
Yeah. I mean, I think personally for me, fasting helped me regulate my portions. Like, because if I don't eat for a day, the next day when I start eating, I'm not able to eat as much. So it kind of reset my quantity of food I ate. But it was something, if I didn't practice regularly, I would go back to where I started. So it's definitely all about, are you able to do it on a regular basis? Then, one size fits all for sure.
Correct. And I also, in keeping with what you're just talking about, when you do something over time and you do it consistently and repetitively, your body naturally adjusts. So you start to see a change in your palate. You see a change in the amount of food you can take in. But there is also this element that our stomach is a muscle and it stretches. Yes. And so if you are so used to eating a certain amount, then over time, if that starts to increase, because again, if we're going to how obesity functions as a complex neurohormonal disorder, if those signals are running high, you may not be able to control that as effectively as a person who doesn't have that dysregulation.
So kind of obesity and longevity and anti-aging, they've all seemed to have now kind of become like the core thing, the in thing everyone's talking about, okay? And these anti-aging, longevity medicine and the supplements and the protocols. I mean, for example, cryotherapy, it was the in thing, the ice water plungers and ice baths, it was the in thing at one point. Now we have a study which says cold water plungers can decrease your muscle mass. We are working with limited evidence here. What is your take on that?
My take is that when we start to bucket all of our efforts into one tool, we are going to be wildly unsuccessful. Cryotherapy has a lot of data around recovery, performance enhancement and recovery.
Yes.
I believe that there is evidence around how local targeted cryotherapy can actually help with adipocytes and causing, let's say necrosis, but essentially breaking up those fat cells so that they, causing apoptosis. That is, the understanding is that there are multiple tools in the toolbox. If we bucket everything into one, we will fail. And I think this is why the talk around GLPs, it's not the only tool. If you really want to be successful at this, you can't just be on the GLP train alone, because GLPs will cause what you just talked about, muscle loss, significant muscle loss. So if you're not instituting the right habits, including weightlifting, including resistance training, enough protein intake, and you are not doing a slow weight loss, a gradual weight loss to accommodate for those changes, you're seeing what the society is talking about. Oh, this person has Ozempic face and this person has Ozempic butt and they don't have their muscle. And I heard this once in a talk and I can't remember who, so I want to give credit to them, but they mentioned that muscle is the currency of life. Yes. And when I hear that, it is so imperative to say that just like every other medical condition that we're treating right now, it has to be a multi-pronged approach. And if we are constantly choosing just one tool or even two tools to make us successful in achieving a specific health goal, we will fail because the way that we should be managing these types of conditions is from a very comprehensive, holistic approach. I think that there is benefit for cryotherapy when it comes to weight, but I think it's more on the recovery side, where I look at my individuals who are doing high intent, you know, HIIT exercise. I want them to be able to do this 2 to 3 times a week. I want them to also do resistance training to support the weight loss that they're achieving. How do they do that if they're so sore the very next day? So I'm looking at it as a tool to improve their recovery so that they can do the work that is needed to augment their weight loss.
Fantastic. But now let's go into some more off-label controversial practices, like medications for longevity. Metformin, rapamycin, you know, I had a whole podcast about rapamycin and how this is this fabulous drug, etc. There are people who swear by it, and there are people who are not so sure about those practices. Where do you stand?
There are, again, when we look at a lot of these, we want a medication, we want a treatment, we want something that will help to increase our chances of living healthier for longer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It comes down to each individual, because I can say with certainty that metformin may not be the medication that I would be able to tolerate or that would be most beneficial to me. And when I look at risk of colon cancer and how metformin has been studied to actually improve the chances or reduce the risk of colon cancer in many individuals, I'm going to look at this person, each individual, respective to their medical history and to their family history and what their risks are. I think metformin is an excellent medicine. I've used it for weight loss before a lot of these weight medications came in, used it for polycystic ovarian syndrome, more than just diabetes. And so there's so many indications for metformin. And I've found that one of the key drivers with metformin continues to be that insulin resistance and regulation that we see for metabolic hormones. I think it still comes back to this driver of visceral fat and how do we regulate metabolic dysfunction that is from these adipocytes around our visceral organs. I feel like that is where most of my emphasis has been. So when we talk about things like NAD plus and rapamycin, and you know, there's so much data right now that we are missing as it pertains to central adiposity and how we address that first and foremost. Because if you're not addressing those things, rapamycin and metformin, and they're not going to be as effective.
Absolutely. So you know, you touched upon this, the insulin resistance of it, okay? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that feels like the root cause, insulin resistance. While there are drugs to overcome insulin resistance, what do you recommend your patients or anyone who's listening to this podcast, what can they do at home to kind of stave off or improve their insulin sensitivity?
Yeah, great question. There have been, I would say, two things that I tell my patients the most, whether they are on GLP-1s, whether they're trying to lose weight. I say this to my patients who are going through hormonal therapy for menopause and andropause. I give them key areas of focus pertaining to exercise and their dietary intake. When we specifically for protein, I think in order to build muscle, which I go back to muscle being the currency of life, if I want to build and retain muscle, especially as we age, being able to maintain our muscle mass decreases substantially. You're losing at minimum in certain cases, 10% each decade of life after the age of 40. So when we start to look at how we retain this muscle so that we prevent debility, prevent falls, continue our caloric expenditure the way that it should be, we need to preserve that muscle as much as possible. 0.6 milligrams per kg of protein is what I say to be healthy, is what we should be consuming on a daily basis. However, if you are on a GLP-1, that goes up substantially because the chances of being able to retain that muscle or you're losing muscle in this weight loss journey is a lot higher. But intaking the right amount of protein is important. Secondly, I would say one of the key areas that I tell them to focus and that I found to be the most helpful is that if you can consume 30 grams of that protein within the first meal. That, and now when I say first meal, whether that's the first meal, your first meal of the day, if it's at 7 a.m., great. But if you're like me, who does not eat until 11 a.m., then my first meal, I need to have 30 grams. Helping to regulate my glucose levels for the rest of the day requires on having a larger protein burden earlier on in your, when we look at circadian rhythm. Yes. So you want to have that protein earlier on in the day when your insulin and glucagon, when that cycle starts to kick in, you want to have protein to help regulate those levels. So for those individuals who are insulin resistant, who are dealing with this at home, the best ways to mitigate that is through muscle building, through protein intake.
For those folks who are on GLP-1, clearly they can't eat much. The amount, quantity of meals they eat is really, really low. They skip several meals. How are they they feel sick, right? When they consume a large amount of food, they even have to go throw up. So how do they even regulate it and how do they even get those protein intake?
Yeah, great question. This is part of the reason why I don't typically raise my patients on their dosing every single month. You'll see a lot of practitioners try to get them up to the max doses as quickly and efficiently as possible, whereas I try to keep them on the lowest effective dose for as long as possible. It may be that they're achieving a 2 pound or a 4 pound weight loss per month. That's actually perfect because that is where you start to see the balance of body composition with visceral fat reduction and muscle being able to be retained or at minimum being lost minimally. So I usually start them off low. How they get that in, the appetite suppression that you see is also dose dependent. So as you start to go up in dosing, you'll see that the suppression on appetite goes down even further. So what I usually tell patients is I am always leaning towards natural forms of protein as much as possible. Protein dense foods, things like Greek yogurt, tempeh, you know, those tend to be my go-to. But if you absolutely can't take that in, liquid protein goes down a lot easier. So there's a couple of options there, but truth be told, for those individuals who are really struggling with getting it in, I usually tell them to lead with the protein first at their meal. They may have to have 3 to 5 smaller meals per day. They may have to have those smaller meals start with their protein, a fruit and vegetable or a fiber food immediately after. And then I usually tell them, if you still feel like you want to have a complete meal, you can consume more. It's up to you how, the types of foods you take in. I give them a very detailed list of the types of acceptable foods. But truth be told, I also want them to find the joy in their day-to-day habits as much as possible. So in when I tell my patients who are on GLPs, more often than not, their appetite is suppressed, but not so diminished where they can't take in the 30 grams in the first meal.
That's interesting. So prioritizing protein, it's a kind of a mantra I've preached all through the first season of Reboot with Dr. R.C. Marin. And muscle is medicine and muscle is the longevity tool. Again, another option. But despite all this, I still feel, you know, strength training, resistance training, people are not fans of it. They prefer, I mean, walking, I'm not against walking, but they seem to think the stroll in the park they do, which is more of a social event than an exercise, is enough as we grow older.
Yeah, any thoughts there? I can say certainly, I have come up with every possible excuse you could think of. So I understand my patients when they tell me this. And for that reason, I've also come up with alternatives for them to be able to incorporate the resistance training. I think the hardest part to overcome is getting started. It has always been the case when you think of every diet, anything new, it's really just getting started that is always the greatest hurdle to jump over. So my ask to patients, okay, if you are somebody that just prefers to go on a stroll in the park, or you are certain that you walk your dog every single day, if you are a mom, you're probably preparing food, you're probably cleaning the house, I encourage them to get ankle weights and I encourage them to get a weighted vest. Nice. Either one of those things has been the impetus to get people into the strength training. They actually see that changing nothing in their routine, but just adding that extra weight allows them to be a little bit more accelerated in their weight loss. And they see the difference in their energy, in the energy output. They feel more tired. They walk their dog. They walk normally for 30 minutes, but after 15 minutes, they are more tired because that energy expenditure is very clear just by adding that extra weight. So I usually will start my patients by saying, don't do anything different in this moment. Let's just add something to your routine. And it's something as simple as an ankle weight or a weighted vest.
That's, you know, that's actually fantastic advice. I'm going to take that. Not changing anything, but just add the ankle weight or a weighted vest is very simple, very practical, very doable. That's fabulous.
And so, that will be the kickstart for people to get that healthy path.
So after 15 years in practice, what has surprised you the most about human health and healing?
Oh, great question. I think the thing that surprises me the most is how long people will go before they seek that help.
Yes.
And how much an individual is willing to put up with before they seek that help. And I'm saying this even for myself, RC. As I said, I have been the quintessential patient to describe what it was like to just kind of float through. I have gone through IVF therapy because I had PCOS and I could not get that regulated. And I, going through medical school and working with physicians and learning the physiology behind it, still could not grasp what the root cause of it was. And neither could the people who were taking care of me. Yeah. And I feel like it was, if this is something I myself have experienced, then my patients are likely going to be experiencing far worse, to be honest. Yes, I think absolutely. That we as physicians have a little bit of an advantage in this sense. So I really felt for the patients that I would see that would just come in saying, I just don't feel like myself. I want to feel better. I want to, you know, it's not just about looking better, but it's just about feeling like yourself feeling again. Better. And so I have learned over time that people will seek temporary solutions to get to, you know, the next step. But really, if we could equip ourselves as physicians, as clinicians, with the right information, with taking a more comprehensive approach and meeting a patient where they're at, they're more than likely to spearhead that journey. And so what I have a lot of my patients who have waited years and years and years dealing with weight gain, dealing with fatigue and sleep deprivation and, you know, feeling depressed, and they get to the point of no return. And that's when they say, okay, I can't do this anymore. I wish I would have captured them earlier on.
Sure. You know, I think the same, when I was asking the question, I was also answering it in my head. What surprised me the most about human health and healing? I think for me, it's very similar. My answer is very similar to yours, but I also find it surprising that patients are people, including myself, very resistant to change. Yes. Any change, even if the change in behavior can be beneficial for them, they are still resistant to the change. And that has surprised me the most. Like, you present them with overwhelming evidence that this is good for you, but the resistance to change is quite overwhelming at times.
Well, we need to see the outcomes, right? And when you are somebody who you're trying to encourage your patient to change, you're encouraging them to take a different path, they want to know what the outcome is going to be. Yeah. And so I think it's our job almost as physicians to see, recognize, and celebrate those small gains right out the gate. I oftentimes will encourage my patients to recheck some of their labs 3 months into it, even if they haven't achieved their weight loss, or even if we haven't achieved their cholesterol management the way that we wanted, I'm encouraging them to do it because I make them go back to what it was the first time, always looking retrospectively. Yeah. It can be, I can't tell you the number of patients, especially on my weight loss panel, that are just like, well, I didn't lose any weight. You know, I didn't lose any weight. this last month, Dr. Kumar, I really feel like I need to increase my medication. And I will go back and I say, well, you've lost 20 pounds in the last 3 months. That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, but it's really hard to be in that moment and see the progress. Somebody, I had read somewhere that it is really hard to see progress when you're constantly raising the bar. And I think we as individuals are always, you know, trying to level up ourselves and not recognize the progress. And I think that is our job as physicians, as, you know, cardiology, primary care, to be able to get patients to look back, to take that moment to reflect and go back and say, look at how far you've come.
Yes, yes, yes. You know, Bobby, this has been such a fabulous conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself, and I love all these little actionable steps you have given all throughout. So now tell me something. What is one health practice do you personally follow that might surprise your patients?
Oh, that is, I would say, probably a very loaded question, because I think it's more of what I don't follow. No, I'm kidding. I think the thing that I do practice and I try to preach as well, we have one life. And if we are constantly bound by numbers, the number of calories we should take in, what our weight should be, if everything is built around numbers, it is really not a life worth living. So I encourage my patients, as part of like the diet that I give them, you may have a vice. You may have something that it brings you your joy. For me, it is the coffee. I have to have my coffee every day, and my coffee will for sure have some sort of sweetener, sugar, or creamer of some kind. But that is my vice. I'm not going to make someone give that up.
Yeah,
because absolutely. The idea around it is to build sustainable habits around that. If you're doing all the other things besides that, I am not going to take away your body. And so I always tell people, whatever that vice is, I'm not going to focus on that part. There should be something that you can rely on to say that that's going to be my source of joy.
Yes.
Everything else, though, I feel like has ways to incrementally improve or optimize. And those are the steps that I focus on.
That's so. Now, let me give you another loaded question. What truly matters for longevity?
If I were to summarize it, and I don't know, you know, there's, if you look at all the studies, there's going to be medications, there's going to be supplements, there's going to be behavioral habits. I have found that probably the one driver in multitude of behavioral habits is stress.
Mm.
How it, the cascade of inflammation that occurs in your body, how it affects sleep, how it affects mood, how it affects your relationships, and how all of those things perpetuate stress.
Yes.
But I do think that stress as a driver, if we can mitigate the impact that stress has on our bodies, you will find the number of things that impact aging to substantially reduce.
Fabulous. Very well said. And I couldn't agree with you more, because I think we have underestimated stress for a long, long time. And I think finally it is getting the attention it needs. Well, Bobby, I want to thank you for bringing your thoughtful perspectives to complex and controversial topics we've discussed today. You've given our listeners much to consider about their own health journeys and the possibilities that exist beyond the conventional approach. And truly, what I found most valuable with what you have said is you're still maintaining that scientific integrity and evidence-based approach while, you know, embracing innovation and also personalization, and especially in this world where it's all about health headlines and quick fixes, I truly find your approach very balanced and very sane and grounded. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much for having me, RC. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. So to our listeners, if you found today's conversation interesting and it sparked questions about your own health and well-being, just remember there isn't one size that fits all. The controversies we've discussed today remind us that medicine continues to evolve, and sometimes the most powerful health interventions come when we are willing to look beyond what has already been established. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone who might benefit from these insights, and join us again next week for another interesting episode on a similar controversial topic. Until then, this is Dr. Arasi Marin reminding you that sometimes the most profound health transformation begins with a simple reboot. With that, see you all later. Thank you, Bobby.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you found us valuable, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcast app. And also, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as that helps others find the podcast too. I hope you have a great week ahead.